Good morning, everyone. This question of, do we need a guru, at least to those of us who have spent even a very little time trying to make it on the path ourselves, would at first seem like a rather simple one. Yesterday, just for fun, when I was starting to think about the topic, I Googled the question, do we need a guru? And I love doing that with some of these services now. It's actually very interesting what's out there, that I, being someone who does not usually surf the web, if we're even still using that phrase, don't know that much about. But what intrigued me yesterday when I did that is that the first four or five, which is all I read, sites that popped up were by people not of our path, but of other paths. And the answers were 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. This is a pretty important question. What are they going to say? So I open the first one, and there's a man who I think might be a disciple of Amma, but I'm not sure. And he says, what kind of a question is this? What kind of a question? He goes, now just think about Wimbledon. This is what he says. Who would you bet your money on at Wimbledon? Would you bet your money on somebody who never had a coach, who never took a lesson? Of course not. You'd bet your money on somebody who had a coach. That's the answer to the question. That's okay. The next, I'll just share one more with you. They were adorable. The next one was Sadhguru. I've never watched him before, but I know he's held in very high esteem by a lot of people. But he started too with that. I don't want to misquote him. I don't think he said, what kind of a question is this? But it was sort of in his attitude. When he said, just think of your letters. He must have been speaking to an American audience. He said, you have 26 letters. 26. That's it. How long do you spend learning those letters and how to use them? So I thought Swamiji actually dealt with it very well by giving us so many other examples of just how important it is to have guidance. But it's complicated for us, particularly as Westerners. And I say that including all of you who I see out there who may not have been born here, but who have now brought yourself to this part of the world, to this culture, a culture that is very intellectual, that loves to prove, know and prove everything, to a culture that's very skeptical. I mean, people doubt a lot, that really wants to try and figure it out with our minds. Well, it's very hard to make the leap from the deep desire to do that, to be in a place where we've gotten a little confused. I was even thinking this morning, boy, this reminds me of the Jewish people 2018 and a half years ago, you know, when Christ had to come because they were confused. We've turned a certain kind of, not even just material success, yes, that, but intellectual success in many ways into our guru. We've actually allowed ourselves to think for a very long time that those kinds of successes will help us discover the answers to life, to find happiness. And it's a state of great confusion. And here come these gurus, very obvious for us, with Yogananda, because he had to get on a boat from a pretty far away place and bring himself all the way here to say to us, a guru's role is to show you a new way of understanding life and of living it. And the ego's role in life is exactly to resist that. So it is very complicated. I was looking last night, I don't quite know what made me open the autobiography, but I opened to Swamiji's foreword of this edition of the autobiography. This edition is an exact replica, word by word, of Yogananda's writing of the autobiography that was published in 1946. Subsequent to that, there were a lot of changes made in the book by the people at SRF. They re-edited the book. And for years, this bothered Swamiji because he felt that a lot of masters' true meaning and honestly his vibration, which is so important in a guru-disciple relationship, the most important thing the guru is giving us is his or her vibration. So finally, after a long struggle, which I'll just say in one sentence, it was a long struggle, we were able to republish this book. And Swamiji wrote just a little foreword to it. And I just wanted to read to you two of the last three paragraphs that he wrote. He said, "Dear reader, if you are willing to risk a complete change in your life outlook," these are intense words. "If you're willing to risk a complete change in your life outlook, read this book. I promise you, it won't devastate you. Rather, you will gain from it joyful new insight into what life is really about. Gurus come to show us a new way of looking at and understanding life." And this is just what Swamiji said. And then he says, "There were, I confess, things in this book." This is Swami Kriyananda, who we all know then went on to be a disciple for 65 years, every minute of his life. "There were, I confess, things in his book that I had to place mentally on a shelf, certainly not because I disbelieved them, for my faith in him was complete, yet things nevertheless for which my skeptical modern upbringing had not prepared me. The longer I lived with him, however, the more aware I became that wonders," and then he says, well, why mince words? "Miracles, they were an everyday feature of his life." It's a very powerful foreword and opening because he says you have to be ready to have all of what you thought life was about and what's important be changed. I was trying to think last night, what was the first time in my own life? Because these things they're important for us to think about. Everybody can think about your first time where you realized that life was not what you thought it was, that something dramatically different than what these little minds tell us is happening. And I remembered, this was, I have to tell you, long after many miracles had happened in my life. I was a slow awakener. I mean, Master had already done everything up to and including, not going to tell these stories, lift me up, put me in medical school. I mean, many of you have heard these stories. This was later. It was the very end of medical school. I was still totally unconscious, 4 years into Ananda. And I went to India. Now, I don't know how many of you have been to India, but this was in 1983. And I don't know how much Mumbai has changed since that time. But my husband and I decided to go to India, and a week later we were on a plane. We knew nothing about India. We made no plans. We did nothing. We decided to go because a man who I had become drawn to, Sankeshava Das, was in India, And he had said to us before he left, come and see me. Now, I was in the middle of my internship. You do not pick up from a medical internship and leave. But I did. That was the first thing that I didn't notice. We fly to India and we get off the plane in Mumbai. It's an experience. If you flew to Mumbai and got off the plane, walked around the airport, and came back, you would have a big experience of India. We land at 2 o'clock in the morning. We don't know where we're going. We're going to find Sant Keshavadas in Mumbai. I swear to you, that's all we knew. It was the most absurd thing in the world. So we get in an Indian version of a taxi, not a taxi, open, and we start this drive, which is about a 1 hour drive. This is after getting through customs, all of that. Your senses are immediately taken. Everything's different. If you imagine Manhattan 100 times, 24/7, India, Mumbai, the smells are different. You don't speak the language. People are dressed differently or barely dressed. It's just hard to describe. You can't. It's beyond words. And we start this drive into Mumbai, and it took me 10 minutes to realize that what I was seeing along the road, it's 2 in the morning, it's about 85 degrees, people are cooking on the street. Anybody in this room from India, they're shaking their heads. I'm not exaggerating. Then I realized those are bodies. I mean, India gives a whole new definition to a lot of words that we use all the time. Homelessness was one of them. It's the middle of the night. We can't speak the language. This man, not a highly educated man who's driving us, take us to Mumbai, is what I said. We get there, he stops, he's looking at us, we're looking at him. We don't know what to do, he doesn't know what to do. And the idea comes to me, take us to the Taj Mahal. No, the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai. So he does. I figured somebody there had to speak English. I walk up to the porter, and I tell him, he said, what's the problem? I said, we don't know where we're going. He said, what are you looking for? This is a true story. Honestly, you know I would only tell the truth right here. I said to him, Sant Keshavadas. He says, who's that? I said, he's a teacher. He says to me, just like this, no problem. He goes into the hotel. He comes back out 10, 15 minutes later. He says something to this driver that I do not understand, of course. The driver's driving and driving and driving. Finally, he stops. He points to a door. I sit there. I knock on the door, and down walks Sant Keshavadas. I stood there and I stared at him, literally with those words going through my mind. Shanti, you have no idea what's going on here. You have no idea. There is so much more to life than you can imagine. That's what came to me. Now, we come in, part of the human condition is this state called Maya, delusion, which is what the ego is about. It's its job. It does a great job. Most of us know that. It keeps us bound to things, some of which are a little embarrassing, jealousy, greed, anger, angst, hate, competitiveness, insecurity. And then there's the guru. And the word itself, guru, means dispeller of darkness. That's what ru means. Gu means the darkness. I heard Ananta talking about this once. He says, you know what gu is. Gu. And then there's ru, the dispeller of that. And then he stopped and he said, gu. Same word in Hindu as it is in English. And it's true. The dispeller of darkness. That one who can lift us up. This is what it means. We have all of that in us from the moment we enter. But most of us here, when we're in this state of angst, anger, jealousy, we say, this isn't right. This doesn't feel right. And we're drawn towards that other peace. That's what we call the spiritual path. That's what we're doing. We're saying, I don't want to live here. I want to be lifted up. We don't use those words very early on, probably for a few thousand years, or lifetimes, at least a few thousand, maybe hundreds of thousands. But eventually, we know that. And even before we know it, we are drawn there because that's the nature of the path. We are drawn to the guru. Guru really means that place of pure divine wisdom, that which is already in us, that place of pure love, pure peace. We are drawn there. We look for it sometimes in very distorted ways, but we're on our way. But the ego is there, and it's so good at what it does. It plants so many delusions in our mind. It insinuates itself into every experience of our lives. This is the depth and meaning of a story that Yogananda used to love to tell. And many of us have heard it, but it's a very important story of a man who is being bothered by a demon. And he read about a ritual where you found a certain powder, you created it, and if you threw that powder at the demon would disappear, he would quit bothering you. So he did that. He made the powder, and as he goes to throw it on the demon just laughs in his face. He says, before you even, at your first thought of the powder, I myself was in the powder. You can't fight the ego with the ego, which is what we often try and do. We often try and improve ourselves, expand ourselves, do better, get clarity, mostly driven by our ego. But the ego is so filled with delusion, it is already infected with the disease of egotism. That's what's happening with it. So we are in this big bind because it's all we know. Most of us consider it our best tool. We're smart, after all. Most of us are pretty successful in the world. But here we are trying to move spiritually. And what we have is our ego. It's never going to work. Never. In no way. It simply cannot. It's the nature of the ego to take us away from the dispeller of darkness. And then, as if the ego wasn't enough in and of itself, here's the other thing. Most of us are moving, all of us, this is not casting aspersions on anyone. It's the nature of karma and reincarnation, of having an astral spine. We are living, acting, having likes, dislikes, drawn to many things, repelled by others, based on things we're completely unaware of. We are completely unconscious of what has turned us into most of what we call ourselves. I was thinking about this because we don't remember, and yet we move in terms of them. Many of you have heard me say that I am fairly certain that I died in the Holocaust in the 40s. And last night I started thinking, you know, you always say you died in the Holocaust. I think I did. What did I go through in the Holocaust before I died? Was I tortured? Were experiments done on me? Did I come to near starvation? Was I desperate for food? did I lose my whole family and every single thing I had ever had in the world before I actually had the great luxury of leaving this body? I always say I died. And if that's the case, which it most likely is, if you die in the Holocaust, you're pretty lucky if you were just lined up and shot, but who knows? What effect does all of that have on me? How is that fed into subtle fears, desires to reach for security in ways that I don't even understand, but I tell myself, you'll be secure if you do that. You see, so much of our lives are spent reacting to things that are unconscious in us. This is where the guru steps in. This is where these beautiful souls who have the ability to lift us up out of ego consciousness into soul consciousness, to be with us in ways that our minds will never understand, that open our hearts and give us the ability to feel inspired, to know truth beyond thought, beyond belief, to find faith, which is not belief, which cannot be found in the written word, which we spend so much time studying, but rather going towards an experience that becomes undeniable. These great souls come back filled with pure divine power. They come back wanting to inspire us. They come back with the ability to open our hearts if we invite them. They come back wanting to help us transcend ego consciousness. And they are able. Why? Because they're not trying to teach us. They fill us with their vibration. And it is that vibration that becomes the extraordinary power of the guru-disciple relationship. I'm laughing because in the very opening lines of the autobiography, Yogananda talks about that the essence of India is to constantly be searching for eternal verities, he calls them, eternal truths, Sanatan Dharma. And then he says, hence from that springs the disciple-guru relationship. Why? Because we have to invite God in. We have free will. He will not take one step into our lives without the invitation. But with the invitation comes this vibration that carries all of the power for eternity of this relationship that can free us of all delusion, that can lift us up into a state of perfect joy and bliss. If we even think we want that, the answer is yes, we need a guru. We always laugh when we hear that comment that Swami Kriyananda made to an announcer who was, somebody who was doing an interview with him and asked him, do you need a guru? And Swamiji answered, no, you don't need a guru. He even went on to say, why would you want somebody telling you what to do all the time in your life? But then he paused, perfect pregnant pause, unless you want to find God. If you want to find God, those are two other words we'd have to define. That's another sermon. But really what it means is no true joy, no true bliss. Become your absolute best self, which is so beyond yourself. We have no idea. How did Sankeshava Das find me in Mumbai and just have me go to the Taj Mahal Hotel and have that man? It's impossible. You have to understand, not for them. Nothing is impossible for them. Everything we want through that vibration, that's the power in these relationships. That's why Yogananda went back in 1935 to India and went from being this great guru, the first ever to come and live in the United States and live here and practice and teach here, and goes back to India. And Richard Wright, who was with him, writes in his diary, lays himself at his guru's feet. Richard Wright was, his mouth dropped open. He says that. That's his guru. Nobody behaved that way around Yogananda here. Nobody. You couldn't get people away from his feet taking the blessing. He goes right back to Sri Yukteswar's feet and bows down. And that's why Jesus went to John and said, baptize me. John says, what would I have to give you? And Jesus says, no, for righteousness' sake. Because the blessing is such a deep blessing. It's the blessing of the awareness of the divine. That's the power in the guru-disciple relationship. And we have to do our very best. It's very hard. There is a leap of faith because it's so hard for us to know when we need help. Most of us are busy making decisions. As Asha always says, felt like a good decision at the moment. And then later, what was I thinking? Well, you were thinking. That was your first problem. If you get out of thinking and go to the guru. I'll end now with just a beautiful story about Sister Gyanamata, who we know was Master's most highly evolved female disciple. She didn't even meet Master till she was in her 50s. But she says in her book, I knew from my studies of Indian teachings that I needed a guru. But there was no guru to be found. The guru wasn't appearing. She said, I felt then to make life my guru. Here's a beautiful lesson for us. I felt to make life my guru. She was a highly evolved soul, so she did this well. And to realize that every experience that came to me in life, every experience that came to me in life, came to me as my guru, came to me handing me the experience that would lead me towards realization of the divine. And no matter what it was that it came, I bowed at life's feet for bringing it to me. It takes a lot of courage. It takes huge commitment. It takes enormous devotion to do that. How many times do we want to fight or do we complain? I was in the middle of preparing this talk last night and I got a text from somebody about something. Doesn't matter what it was. Right off. Why are they treating me that way? Blah, 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 blah. It's like, Shanti, you're just reading Sister Gyanamata's chapter on this. And even then, it's a challenge, but so what? Where else are we going? What else will we do? We happen to have a guru, many of us, and we have Swami Kriyananda, who's working on our behalf. We have a lot of help, but just know that everything that comes to us in life is on their behalf. And his sister said, I bowed at its feet, no matter what, like it was my guru. God bless you.
Streets I went. I've seen a star rise in the east, and I'm looking for a friend. From a lowly valley we ascend. A wondrous vision sent us here. We're looking for a friend. Learned men, where are you going? Our soul's long journey we would end. Therefore we've come to Bethlehem. We're looking for a friend. People, let me come with you. Perhaps he's just around this bend. But whether near